You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Carver. So much is going on in the world that it seems a long time since Donald Trump announced he was pulling the plug on the Paris Climate Agreement. But in fact, it was only 2 weeks ago. America's withdrawal doesn't spell the end of the agreement. China, the EU, and others have all underlined that they will continue to abide by the commitments that they signed. And some are claiming that Trump's decision may actually accelerate the progress towards a green economy by spurring hundreds of new initiatives at sub-federal level and in the private sector. For example, despite Donald Trump's claims about rebuilding the coal industry, twice as many people in the US are now employed in solar as in coal. And the biggest solar and wind projects are overwhelmingly in the so-called red states where many of Trump's supporters live. So what effect will this move by the president have on the clean energy economy? Here with me in the podcast studio, I'm pleased to have Jigar Shaw, founder and CEO of Generate Capital and previously founder of the solar company Sun Edison, Lisa Hagerman, director of programs at DBL Partners, an impact venture capital firm, and David Livingston, associate fellow in Carnegie's Energy and Climate Program. And they're all in the building today for an event we're doing on innovation and climate change. So welcome to you all. David, let me just start with you, because I'm sure all three of you have lots of theories about the political background and reasons why the president decided to pull America out of Paris. But I really want to focus on the practical ramifications. So he gets up and he says this on June the 1st. What happens now?
Well, Tom, I would say that the practical implications of this are going to be relatively small, actually, compared to the kind of symbolic or diplomatic repercussions. And on the latter, we just don't know yet. Obviously, China's going to try and take advantage of this. India seems to be actually, instead of retreating, doubling down its commitments. And the EU will continue to play a leadership role. This is what we know in the diplomatic area. And there will be a lot of moving parts there. On the market side of things, it seems like there will be fewer moving parts. If this were 5 years ago, maybe there would be the danger that the clean energy revolution or the move towards more low-carbon energy and innovation would be stalled. But at this point, I think the genie's out of the bottle and it's difficult to put it back. So, for example, Bloomberg just came out with a report that shows that just based on the current policy trajectory, there's going to be about $10 trillion invested in new power generation capacity worldwide to the year 2040. Of this, more than 70% of it is going to be renewable. Over $7 trillion is going to be in the renewable field. That means that the United States will continue, U.S. businesses and corporations at least, will continue to try and seize those market opportunities. Now, the major question is whether they're going to be in the U.S. or whether they're going to be abroad. And I'd argue that this decision doesn't change too much of that. Of course, the largest growing markets for clean energy are in the Asia-Pacific and in the emerging world, but the U.S. still has a long way to go as well. And on this, the symbolic politics of Trump's announcement are a lot different than the reality on the ground.
So. Right. I mean, just before we go into the private sector, what I was hoping to get is a sense of what it means in terms of the government actions. Does it have any impact immediately on what the American government itself does, and does that affect and have ripple effects on the private sector?
In terms of the announcement that Trump made, it's important to remember that he didn't even withdraw from the Paris Agreement when he was standing in the Rose Garden and made his announcement. He simply announced that in 3 years' time, when he's legally able to notify the UN of his intent to withdraw, he plans to notify his intent to withdraw.
Okay, and even so that's at that really point, important. So everything continues.
Exactly. Everything continues. The U.S. remains in. And the other thing is that he was already going to change domestic policies. So from fuel efficiency standards for vehicles to clean power plan, to oil and gas methane regulations. He was already unwinding a lot of what President Obama did. And so his being in the Paris Agreement or out of the Paris Agreement or intending to withdraw or not has little difference overall on the emissions trajectory that we were going to see over the next 4 to 5 years.
Okay. So, Jigar, there you are, CEO, a lot of experience in the clean energy economy. You hear what he says, what the president says. What impact does it have on your business?
Well, I think as an investor, you have to separate the sort of emotionally charged environment that we're in around this president and the sort of fact pattern by which you invest. I think, you know, people forget, but one of the first things Bush did was leave the Kyoto protocol and Kyoto conversations, right? So this is not unprecedented. I think that the U.S. has long been unwilling to get involved in these agreements globally. So, but U.S. entrepreneurs still went overseas and you know, traded methane to turn into CO2 credits and made money off of, like, you know, buyers of those credits. And so from an entrepreneur standpoint, you know, U.S. entrepreneurs are still going to be very active around selling their climate solutions around the world. And I don't think that changes in any way. I also think that U.S. funding mechanisms like the Overseas Private Investment Corp or the Export-Import Bank and others will continue to be active in promoting climate solutions on behalf of U.S. companies in these countries. And so I don't think the trajectory is changed. And in some cases, you can make the case that it's actually improved, because while governors and mayors have long said that they believe in climate change and want to do something about it, it's amazing how flat their policies have been. They have not been as progressive as their rhetoric has been. And now, to prove to the president that they actually really dislike his decision, they're actually moving in a way that they weren't moving before. And so, you know, Jerry Brown has done some interesting stuff, but a lot of the best legislation came into effect not under his watch, but instead under Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he got on the next plane to China and made sure that he cut a deal with China, which he probably wouldn't have done if President Trump wasn't planning on leaving the Paris Accord.
That's an interesting point of view, because I mean, so what you're saying is it was largely rhetoric before, and now it's going to force them into action.
They don't want to look like, you know, another emperor that has no clothes. They actually want to look like the leading, you know, rhetorical providers that they are, and now they actually want to bring action behind it.
Hmm. Lisa, you look at all this from the point of view of finance. I mean, David just quoted an astonishing figure about how much investment may or may not go into clean energy. I mean, how do you – let me ask you the same question. I mean, you heard him say this thing in June the 1st. I mean, what impact do you think it's going to have in your world?
Well, I think a big part of DBL's work is focused on public policy, to the working on issues for the benefit of our the industries that our portfolio companies are in. And so in the past, we were an early institutional investor in SolarCity and have been very active on net metering. That really spurred the growth of the solar industry. And I echo Jigar's point that, you know, now we're seeing the states really kick into action. There was, in fact, just yesterday, there was an article in the New York Times, The Green Revolution Will Happen Without Trump, by Vika Spajaj and Stuart Thompson, that a dozen states and 300-plus cities have pledged to reduce greenhouse gases emissions in line with the Paris targets. And, you know, in terms of, you know, as it directly relates, you know, either you know, moving beyond the federal level, where we're seeing a lot of, you know, potential cuts in programs, to then the state level, with new legislation being passed. For example, Governor Sandoval signed last week reinstating rooftop solar. That's going to significantly bring back, you know, solar in Nevada, jobs in Nevada. Similarly, we saw Governor Scott in Florida sign legislation to spur the solar industry and create jobs. So all of these state programs are sending a signal to the market that there is a market, and it's spurring innovation and new companies step up and be creative. And we're, you know, as Jigar knows very well, you know, we're seeing a combination of solar and energy storage. And, you know, energy storage is sort of the crux of all of this.
And isn't one of the challenges that if you just do it at this kind of sub-federal level, you get, how do you say, a kind of carbon leakage, right? I mean, you get companies that, you know, maybe don't want to do this, and so they can move to a different state.
Yeah, I mean, that you've hit the nail on the head. I think there are two weaknesses or two challenges, is probably the better way to put it, for this nascent movement to unify all the efforts of cities, states, and corporations in filling in the gap that's left by a potential withdrawal from the Paris Agreement on the part of the U.S. Number one is carbon leakage, as you said. So if California goes way beyond and does 20% above, you know, what it's already said it's going to do, who's to say that 10% of that 20% is just carbon-intensive businesses that leave California and go to a state like North Dakota or Texas or Louisiana that doesn't sign up to any sort of Paris commitment? So we're going to have a huge accounting challenge that we're going to have to deal with. That's on one hand. On the other hand, you've also got the fact that the global diplomatic process also still matters. And we've got to put pressure on other countries by showing what the U.S. is still doing. And, you know, 1,200 different mayors, governors, and CEOs are going to have one voice in that process to be effective. At the end of the day, at the next UN climate conference, it's going to be Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and not a mayor like or a former mayor like Michael Bloomberg who's going to be showing up and representing the United States. So this nascent coalition is going to have to find a diplomatic identity and voice as well.
Do you share that view, Jigar?
No, I think that the reality of the situation, which is lost on, I think, almost everyone, is that Copenhagen was really a shared sacrifice conference. It was like everyone needs to spend the equivalent of a cup of coffee per month extra to solve the climate crisis, right? Paris was a deeply hopeful and optimistic agreement that was signed up to by China and India, not because of shared sacrifice, but because this is by far the largest wealth creation opportunity of a generation. And they wanted to be at the forefront of that wealth creation opportunity. So to suggest that North Dakota and Texas are not interested in money and are interested in actually like, you know, like attracting the next round of bankrupt companies to come visit their state so they can subsidize them forever seems short-sighted. I mean, in fact, North Dakota and Texas want to be leaders in this space because they want the investment. Texas is already the leading state in the country on wind energy, and their Electricity Reliability Council has now declared that for the next 10 years, they believe that 100% of all incremental new electricity generation in Texas is going to be solar. And on the federal government level, you see the same thing, right? Which is that when you looked at the continuing resolution passed by Congress, they ignored all of the White House's recommendations and reinstated all of the money that was supposedly cut, except for some of the EPA budget was going down by 1%. But all of the money for innovation, all the money for energy efficiency, renewable energy was restored in this continuing resolution. And we'll see
These
what
are
happens.
Subsidies we're talking about.
Well, not subsidies. It's more research, I would say. But but the reason that they were restored is because a lot of these labs are in their states. They want those scientists to continue to get jobs. They, you know, whether it's Nevada or North Dakota or other places, they all have entrenched interests in wanting to see this go forward. Iowa, right, has over 50% of their electricity now comes from wind, and they're on track to being over 80% wind energy by the end of the decade. So at some point, the rhetoric just flies out the window and bows down to the mantle of capitalism.
I guess where the group that are in a bit of a bind on this are kind of Republican governors, right, who kind of have to walk the line between, like you say, needing to continue to create jobs, but then also towing the Republican line that Paris is bad.
No, they've let the Republican line go. Yeah. When you look at John Kasich in Ohio, he told his conservative colleagues in the state assembly that I'm going to veto your bill. This notion that we're going to go backwards is ridiculous. First Energy, the utility company there, who is the most Neanderthal of all utility companies in the country, was told to basically go bankrupt by the governor of Ohio. He said, I'm not subsidizing your coal plant. I'm not subsidizing your bad decisions from the last 10 years. And if you go bankrupt, that's okay, because the other utility companies will buy you and continue the clean energy revolution. And the job creation in Ohio that he wants to spur through wind turbine tower manufacturers and solar frame manufacturers and all the things that they're doing, he wants to keep that momentum going. I mean, it's at this point, the governors of states that are Republican are saying, our job is to keep our people employed and economic development booming. It's not to toe some party line for some donor.
Well, their job is to get reelected, and that requires jobs.
That's right.
Where it gets difficult, though, is bridging supporting goods, which is about, you know, standing up for clean energy subsidies, for example, that might be supporting red states. So like Jigar noted, the six states in the U.S. that have the highest percentage of their power generated from wind all went for Trump. That's how you get a senator like Chuck Grassley from Iowa saying that that President Trump will roll back wind subsidies over his dead body. It's a fascinating dynamic, but that's ultimately about supporting goods, policies that incentivize goods, where we're going to have to bridge and the challenge we're going to have is getting to the next step, which is also putting the proper cost on bads, putting a price on carbon dioxide, putting a price on greenhouse gases. And that's where the major chasm in the Republican Party is right now in the United States.
Right. We can get onto that. You're talking about carbon pricing and so forth. Lisa, in the kind of financial world, do you share Jigar's optimism in the sense that the train has really left the station from a kind of financing point of view, that Paris is going to have no impact on this?
Yes. Now, I might be a little bit California-centric here, but, you know, in terms of for, you know, the California Public Utilities Commission mandated that utilities have to procure 1.8 gigawatts of energy storage by 2020, another signal that, you know, there is a market in energy storage and we're investors in advanced microgrid solutions that's bringing hybrid-electric buildings to parts of Southern California initially, and they have a contract with Southern California Edison. They were one of six other contracts that was in response to the Aliso Canyon gas leak. So there's, and they're already in, they're have also a partnership with Walmart. So they're moving forward. And, you know, similarly, Tesla, of course, with the Gigafactory in Nevada, has already created over approximately 1,000 jobs, and, you know, ultimately is going to get to 10,000 jobs, and, you know, building the power walls that there's already a project with SE at the Mira Loma substation. So I, you know, I concur that there is a lot happening at the state and even the local level as well through community CCAs, you know, their customer choice is a big part of this whole equation.
Right.
And in fact, I was listening in to an 8-hour session that the CPUC ran.
CPUC is what?
The California Public Utilities Commission.
Okay.
An en banc, which I believe technically in French means review to then make a decision. And it was quite interesting because it had everyone from the full spectrum, you know, the utilities to the CCAs, I believe it was a Sonoma,
right,
community choice agreement to individuals, and we're at an inflection point where, you know, one comment was, okay, there's the everyone wants to be their own hotel, can everybody be their own utility? That's
right,
a challenge.
But from the perspective of investment, I mean, I know you invest in sustainable businesses or seek to invest in sustainable businesses. What does that mean in practice? Does that mean a business that has no carbon footprint or the business that is generating sustainable energy? Or how do you define a sustainable business?
So we're DBL partners, and the DBL stands for double bottom line. The first bottom line is financial returns, and we define the second bottom line as social, environmental, and economic impacts in the sectors and regions in which we invest. So we've been around over a decade and we're early institutional investors in Tesla and SolarCity, and have a focus on clean energy, sustainable products and services, IT, and the health sector as well. But, you know, essentially the double bottom line is about investing in a company that has an inherent positive environmental impact through reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, like advanced microgrid solutions, through hybrid electric buildings, reducing the need for coal-fired peaker plants.
But do you require them to have zero carbon footprint?
Embrace zero carbon footprint?
Yeah, as a requirement of investment.
No, and in fact, you know, we have part of the environmental, because I'm the director of programs, so I'm not an investment professional doing diligence on a potential deal that we're going to invest in, but I'm working with our companies after the investment's made. And we helped AMS, Advanced Microgrid Solutions, get their green business certification, that as a clean energy company, they submitted an application and were then able to take advantage of a San Francisco payroll tax exemption, which was 1.5% of their payroll.
Right,
so a direct
right.
savings to them. And in that application, they were, you know, very, very straightforward. I mean, essentially, they're using the Tesla energy storage to create these microgrids and go back and forth between the utility and
right.
energy storage. So there, you know, I think we're at a point where we need to kind of find common ground,
right.
and the utilities still need to keep the lights on. We still need innovation. We have to recognize that the utilities have to maintain the grid while these, startups are creating innovation that's going to get us towards renewables.
Mm. And well, I also think that zero carbon is not the right metric. I mean, zero carbon basically is the way in which people shame, you know, Al Gore into saying, oh, your carbon footprint's high or whatever. I mean, when you think about the work that I've done in my career through SunEdison and now Generate Capital and other things, I mean, we probably have, you know, reduced, you know, carbon in the world through our financial products by over a gigaton of carbon, right? I mean, since 2003. So the companies that we funded, the projects that we funded have saved over a gigaton of carbon. So if I've personally spent, you know, 25 metric tons to like of carbon to be able to fly around the world to actually get the business done, it sort of is what it is, right? I mean, the question is around whether the country as a whole is decarbonizing, and it is. We're 25% less carbon dioxide in our electricity sector today than we had 10 years ago, and we have less carbon dioxide in the transportation sector than we did 10 years ago. And so we're
but the question is whether is it a fast enough rate?
Well, it's never a fast enough rate. I mean, I think it's obvious to all of us.
Well, fast enough rate to meet the Paris requirements.
No. I think. Look, I mean, for all of us who are clear-eyed about this, we're not going to meet the 2-degree hurdle. Like, that's, we're just not there, right? I mean, and to hit that hurdle, we've got to basically get to, you know, 80% reduction by probably 2030. And and I don't know that we're on track to hitting that. That being said, 3 degrees is worse than 2 degrees, and 4 degrees is worse than 3 degrees, right? So we got to stop. We got to get us to someplace, right? And we've got to do this at scale. And I agree with David. Look, I think that the like what Rex Tillerson says around the world is something we're going to have to figure out. But the thing about this is that when you think about the framework that we have operated under post-World War II, right? NATO and the IMF and the World Bank and you know all these other institutions. That whole world changed when the Berlin Wall came down in 89, and no one's put in a new framework. I mean, that is what the Trump administration and Putin and all that is about, right? There is no new framework that we're all working towards. And this climate framework is that new framework. We touch everyone, whether it's around the sustainable development goals and bringing solar power to the 1.2 billion people that don't have electricity today, or whether it's about clean drinking water for the billion people. The entire world order for the last 70 years has failed to meet the tests of eliminating poverty for those people. Our technologies and our businesses are actually doing that. When you look at the number of people with micro loans for solar, the number of customers they serve is larger than almost every utility in the world outside of about 25. Right.
But then you look at something like, I mean, you mentioned Tillerson, you look at something like ExxonMobil, you know, huge company. And when he was CEO, obviously, he said he was in favor of Paris. But, you know, and so I assume he said that not out of altruism, but out of the fact that, you know, it's good for business. But, you know, he's still pulling masses of tons of carbon out of the ground. Right.
But he needs a framework to operate. ExxonMobil can't operate without a framework. You're talking about 35-year, 40-year investments in places like Angola or Russia or Venezuela.
No, but he's still making new 40-year investments.
Yeah. Well, the major oil companies are insignificant, right? I mean, the companies that matter in the oil industry are the ones that are owned by countries, right? They produce 80% of the oil, and the other 20, it comes from these companies like Exxon. They need a license to operate. What Paris allows them to do is a new framework within which to have a conversation on how they might operate. You know, we continue to like fly on planes. We continue to drive cars with gasoline. And so Exxon is still needed in the world today. We're not all on electric vehicles, although the Prime Minister of India wants to move to 100% electric vehicles by 2030. But I think that everyone is desperate for a framework within which to operate. Mm-hmm. You can't just have anarchy and have no frameworks and no conversations and no places to have these things and continue to see people invest hundreds of billions of dollars into these countries. I mean, how would you possibly justify to investors that you can get your money back over 25 years?
What impact does the low price of oil have on all this? I mean, the fact that it's under $50 a barrel.
It's tremendous. I mean, so let's
talk about... It's tremendous as an incentive?
It's tremendous in terms of how it impacts low-carbon innovation, and we can't ignore it. So look at the topic of this event today, innovation itself, right? If you look between 2000 and 2013, the number of new climate mitigation-related patents, so the number of low-carbon patents, let's say, grew at an annual rate of about 10%. which is double the rate seen across all, you know, technological right, patents. Right. But in the year 2013, it started to slow, and it really flattened out in 2014. Now, we're trying to find the – whether it's the Paris Agreement or whether it's state and local level policies, we're trying to find the driver that will get that patenting activity, that will get this innovation activity going again. Why did it fall off in 2013, 2014, just as awareness of climate change was really starting to pick up? It's because the oil price collapsed. It's because the oil price collapsed, and it's because cheap natural gas started competing with coal, and so coal prices dropped as well. And this gets it at one of the major challenges here, which is the more successful we are at using fewer fossil fuels, whether it's oil or whether it's coal, the more they'll drop in price. And the more they'll be used by essentially the largest sources of growing energy demand, the developing world. And so we have to kind of run in place faster and faster just to achieve a slow downward trajectory in the utilization of these high carbon fuels.
But I would say that's correlation.
I just want to get back to the carbon pricing a second, because I don't want to lose that. I mean, you raised it. Do you think all this innovation will kind of peak or not be able to continue to accelerate if you don't have carbon pricing?
Thanks. Innovation is a complicated thing, and we throw it around. But at the end of the day, there are some forms of innovation, or you know, incremental innovation, whatever it might be, that are sensitive, or deployment, let's say, that are sensitive to price differentials. There are others that are very price insensitive. And that's where I think it's the role of governments to step in and do the hard research and development upstream that is necessary in order to get the breakthroughs that we need tomorrow. So deployment today might be sensitive to price differentials or the price of coal or the price, you know, a carbon price, whatever it might be, subsidy levels. But the innovation that we're going to do towards, you know, the flexible, adaptable solar panels of the future, or that we're going to take towards a hydrogen economy or whatever that might be, that's going to be done by government. No corporation is really going to step in and provide those dollars.
Right. And the infrastructure, right, that's needed to get the energy presumably is going to be a government.
Absolutely.
Investment.
I mean, our venture capital system dances on a set of on an infrastructure stage that was put in place by the government in the post-war period.
Right. We've got people hovering around here, wait, because you need to go to an event. There's hundreds of people waiting to hear you repeat all this. But I just want to get in one more question to Jigar. I read, Jigar, a very interesting point you made about you wanted to end all energy subsidies.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, can you just in a nutshell say why that is a good thing at this moment? Because it would seem to me that energy subsidies would continue to boost in innovation and productivity.
Well, I think that, you know, whether it's DBL's work or other people's work, I think it's well stated now that the fossil fuel industry still gets the vast majority of the energy subsidies in the world today. And a lot of those subsidies are actually consumption subsidies, not production subsidies. So we're subsidizing poor people to get kerosene, which then ends up, you know, killing them with smoke inhalation. And so it's better for us to actually get rid of all those subsidies, create a level playing field.
Even to clean energy.
Well, clean energy already competes, right? When you look at the mature clean energy solutions, right? I mean, you know, scaling clean energy solutions will still need subsidies, whether it's battery storage or anaerobic digesters or other things. But like for solar and wind, we're now cheaper than new coal. When you look at Dubai and other places that don't have subsidies, they're buying solar because it's cheaper. Brazil, India, China, they're not in the business of actually overpaying for these resources. And so we're already competing head to head with them. And in fact, we're competing against subsidized fossil fuels in many of those cases, right? When you look at India, right? I mean, India, they pay for the port infrastructure to import coal. They pay for the rail infrastructure to get that coal to the coal plant, right? I mean, they pay for the water that coal plant uses that village next door actually needs, right? So there's a lot of embedded subsidies in coal burning. And so it would be nice. And frankly, the G20 at every meeting in the last 5 years has said that they want to get rid of fossil fuel subsidies globally. They haven't done a darn thing about it, but they at least have talked about it
Sounds
in every
good.
Single one of their meetings.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all very much. I just wanted to note that my country, Britain, I think had an entire coal-free day not long ago in which all the electricity was produced without any coal, which is remarkable.
In the anniversary of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Jigar, Lisa, and David.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.